Good morning, Your Honors. If the court pleases, Matthew L. Tuck appearing on behalf of the petitioner in this case, or the appellant, Kimberly Guadalupe. I know you've read the briefs and you're familiar with the cases, and I'll just launch in. If you have any questions, please interrupt. This is an interesting case in which my client, the appellant, was the girlfriend of a chap who was something of a criminal. His name was Michael Morgan. He was being investigated by the government for a variety of crimes, mostly drug dealing, money laundering, and related offenses, and some weapons.
He was convicted.
He was.
And made admissions during the course of that plea colloquy.
Yes.
So the question as to the currency, at least for me, is how did she show that the money that was seized was actually withdrawn from her business accounts?
Well, that is the
given that
the issue.
He dipped into it regularly.
He did, and the testimony and the discovery in the case showed it was happening mostly without her permission. He had a gambling problem, as the record showed, and what he would do is he knew where she kept the money, and he would just dip into that, borrow it, and then replace it, apparently, later on, without telling her.
So given that evidence, how can she establish that she was the sole owner of that money?
Well, she testified, and this was undisputed, that for years it was her practice and the practice of her family, apparently, to keep a lot of assets in liquid form in the house, about 50%.
No, I understand that, but yeah. Given that this pile of cash, if you will,
yeah.
Everybody, it was uncontested that he occasionally put money into it and took it out, and nobody's contesting that any money that he put in was subject to forfeiture. So how can she establish on this record? Because I don't see any place where she said, well, I know this $6,000 was mine. I put in six and he only took out four and et cetera, et cetera. And as I read the case law, you have to be able to specifically identify the property that is yours. So as to the cash, I just don't see how she could have done that in light of the testimony.
Well, her testimony was that she operated a number of businesses, six different businesses, and that over the course of at least 4 or 5 years, she had withdrawn money from her businesses, and that was the source of the cash. So,
well, it was the source of the cash, except the uncontested testimony was that the boyfriend, Michael, dipped into that pile, took cash out, and then replenished it with what, for purposes of this case, we have to assume were proceeds from his illegal activities. Mm-hmm. So that when we look at the pile of cash that existed on the day of the seizure, I don't know how she could establish how much was hers and how much was his.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that is difficult, especially with cash. As Your Honor points out, I mean, cash is extremely difficult to track unless you have the serial numbers. With 20/20 hindsight, she probably wishes that she had written down all the serial numbers of all the bills she had pulled out of her businesses. And I mean, I probably have $20 or $80 in my wallet right now in tens and twenties. And even though I've only had them in there for a few weeks, I can't tell you where all of those dollars came from.
Well, can we talk about the jewelry?
Sure. Yes, I think that is a separate issue.
Yeah. Here's my problem with the jewelry, and I want you to address it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that she ever said, I can identify a specific piece of jewelry that I acquired with my own money either before meeting Michael or after meeting Michael. All that she said was, I routinely went to various places to buy jewelry, I paid for some of it with my own money. And again, I'm having trouble again here with the notion that you need to identify ownership in a specific piece of jewelry as opposed to saying, I think I bought some of that with my own money and he gave some of it to me, but she didn't identify which. How can she prevail under those circumstances?
Well, and that is one of the troubling aspects of this case, Your Honor, because she was denied an ancillary hearing to prove those very facts. And unfortunately, the trial court basically decided this on a summary proceeding that was based on evidence that was not.
I understand it's in effect a summary judgment.
Yes.
But her proffer during the summary judgment, her affidavits, her testimony, didn't identify any specific piece of jewelry other than the one that the court didn't forfeit. Mm-hmm. Didn't that identify any specific piece of jewelry that she said, I purchased with non-suspect funds, if you will. She just said, I know I bought some of it with my own money. So mm-hmm. in the absence of that specific identification, can she prevail?
I think she can. And part of it was because unlike a lot of the other forfeiture cases that were cited in the briefs, and forfeiture cases seem to fall on kind of a continuum, right? There's ones on the extreme where it's clear that everything in the case was bought with bad money or, you know, with drug money or whatever it was. But on the other extreme, which is this one, you have a long history of the third party petitioners, who had over the years had purchased property, purchased jewelry, accumulated cash. And that's that's this case. And she did testify under oath in her deposition, what a number of the various pieces of jewelry were, the watches and the other things, the pieces that she had purchased for her child. I don't think that there's anything in the case law that requires her to produce receipts for every single.
I don't think so either. I'm looking at her testimony, and I'm not sure I can find a place where she says, mm-hmm. "This ring, this watch, this bracelet, yeah. I purchased it with my own money in such and such a year." As to the stuff that went to the child, some of the stuff she says came from Morgan. So I'm not sure that establishes anything independent. So if you could point to me someplace in the record where she said, this item I purchased with my own money or I purchased prior to the time I met Michael, then I could say there was an issue of fact raised. But in the absence of that, I'm not sure what the ancillary hearing would do.
Well, she was under oath when she testified at the deposition, and she was a bit hamstrung in this case, quite honestly, Your Honor. As the record is clear, and as our brief points out, the government scooped up all of her records when it did the raid with the search warrant back in 2019 when the arrest and the investigation was going on. She didn't get any of those records back until literally the night before her deposition. She didn't have a chance to review it or anything. So there would have been, I believe, testimony in the deposition where she could have said, oh, yes, you know, I this was mine. She had spreadsheets that detailed, detailed the cash withdrawals and transactions that she had engaged in, but she didn't have the benefit of that at her deposition either. She had an appraisal done on the jewelry in 2018, a lot of it, which at least arguably precedes a lot of the criminal activity. She testified under oath again that she had been accumulating this jewelry for 20 years. And so, you know, most of the cases that are cited in the briefs, when there is a long history, of accumulation of whatever it is, of jewelry, of cash, of real property, the courts treat those cases differently. And her testimony was undisputed. The government didn't dispute any of this, and was frankly in possession of a lot of the documents that she would have needed to establish that, which is another reason this should have gone to an actual evidentiary hearing, an ancillary hearing, when she was fully in possession of all of her documents and she could have said, oh, yes, I'm looking at the appraisal now. This ring my mother gave me in, 2002 or this bracelet or whatever. But she never really had that opportunity. And in her deposition, not a good situation. She's nervous. She doesn't have any documents in front of her. And they're saying, okay, what jewelry that you haven't seen in 4 years, was given to you and by whom and how much did it cost and where are the receipts? None of which did she have access to at the time of her deposition or frankly, when she filed these petitions, either the Rule 853 petition or the Rule 41 petitions. And there were two of those. So she's been forced by the government to fight really with one hand or two hands tied behind her back in this case. And all she would really like is a remand. With the opportunity to fully litigate this, not, based on the testimony at a plea bargain hearing of Morgan, which she had no opportunity to contest, and not based on, you know, a bunch of her testimony without any records in front of her. I mean, they were asking her basically to testify to everything from memory. And given the volume, you know, this was $240,000 worth of jewelry. That's a lot of jewelry. Expecting her to remember all that and to remember where she purchased it all without the receipts in front of her, without the records, without the appraisal, with none of that in front of her, is asking an awful lot. And I think that the trial court just erred when it wouldn't let that be more fully investigated in an ancillary proceeding.
Did you want to save the rest of your time?
Pardon me? You cut out for a second.
Want to save some time?
Yeah, let me save 3 minutes for rebuttal, or I guess 4 minutes and 38 seconds. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right.
Morning, Your Honors. David Martin on behalf of the United States. I want to start by addressing the discovery allegations made by opposing counsel here. The way discovery proceeded in this case, what was not provided to Ms. Guadalupe in advance of the deposition, and it was, there was an effort to provide it, but it was the exhibits to be used in the deposition in advance of it. It was a Zoom deposition taken, and a colleague of mine tried to provide the exhibits in advance. Those exhibits were all from discovery that had been produced by the government. Some of them are in the record at SER 15 to 72. Those are photos of the jewelry that were sent. It's an email transmitting those photos sent almost a year, February 2020, so almost a year before the January 2021 deposition.
You have the photos.
She had the
photos in advance. Now, counsel is saying that she was hamstrung because there were receipts and other documents that would have helped her establish an interest in particular pieces of jewelry. What's the status of that?
Copies of all of the business records had been produced.
That's what I was going to ask, because I read the record. I thought the only thing that was tardily produced, for whatever reason, were the actual pictures of the jewelry seized. Is that?
I don't think that's quite accurate either. I think everything had been produced. The photos of the jewelry were sent in February of 2020. That's SER 15.
Was there an inventory that was not produced until later?
I believe Ms. Guadalupe provided the SER 36 to 37, which was her accounting, maybe that's ER 36 to 37, her accounting for and sort of providing an explanation.
Right, although, but that wasn't something that was seized.
That's right, yes.
I'm trying to figure out, counsel said her records were seized and she didn't have them, and I'm not sure I can find that in the record of this case. Is what's your response to that?
That's right. Both in the record of this case and to my knowledge outside of it, I'm not aware of any discovery that was tardily produced. The colloquy, I don't have a pin site handy, but the colloquy at sort of near the outset of the deposition transcripts, which I know is in the record, but I don't have the pin site, shows that the colleague of mine taking the deposition was, had not been able to transmit successfully the exhibits that were to be used, but those exhibits were in fact discovery that had been produced.
So the bottom line is, to the extent there were receipts or other documents from which she could reconstruct her ownership, the government turned that over?
That's right. Yes, Your Honor.
On the Rule 41, are there other relevant proceedings ongoing at this time? Or have those matters now been concluded such that she could renew her motion?
Yeah, thank you for asking, Your Honor. So my understanding of the current status is that Mr. Myers, who was a fugitive at the time the motion was considered, has been apprehended. He has pled guilty and sentencing is pending. And the 2255 petition deadline for Mr. Cheatham has run. So those were two of the sort of underlying concerns the government had. To be clear, though, I think that the way this court should evaluate the Rule 41 petition is as of the time it was decided. As the district court indicated, if Ms. Guadalupe wants to come back and, you know, now that circumstances have changed somewhat and seek to renew that motion, she can do so. And I think based on those changed circumstances.
Sure, that's my understanding. I just wanted to ascertain where we're at, whether
right,
we're further along now.
Yep, that's where we're at.
Does she need to file a new motion, or will the government just on its own accord return the non-forfeited property when it no longer needs it for it?
I think the government could do that on its own accord, certainly if she wanted to have that conversation with the government. It's not something I'm in a position to commit to today, but it's a conversation we're always willing to have when the evidence is no longer needed.
Let me pose a problem that I think occurs all the time in forfeiture, but is sort of highlighted in a case like this. This woman says, I've got a bunch of jewelry that I've accumulated over the years, but I can't tell you precisely when and how I bought each item of it. But this is, that's my testimony. Does she get an evidentiary hearing on that? Or must she, in order to get an evidentiary hearing, say, this ring, this watch was purchased on this date with this money? That's a pretty heavy burden to put on a third party who's not charged in a case.
I agree. I don't think she needs quite the level of specificity that you're suggesting. I do think that she does need to, as your questions earlier suggested, needs to be able to point to the time and circumstances of the acquisition of each piece of property that was subject to seizure. So here, if she had made allegations like, I know that I purchased this particular ring before 2010. That would predate the
before I met Mr. Morgan.
That would allow at least the reasonable inference and to get to the hearing stage that, you know, it's possible that, assuming that's true, that it was acquired, not using criminal proceeds. Of course, that's far from the facts here, and the lack of memory, both in what's in the petition and then what came out in discovery, really just demonstrates that a hearing would serve no end, that and what we would hear at the hearing is what we see in the record, which is just a lack of the ability to do that with respect to the individual pieces of jewelry. And as we talked about earlier, with the specific cash that was seized from the house on that day. For reasons Judge Wynn was identifying, the cash reserve money in, money out theory doesn't work because this is about that specific cash. And this record doesn't allow any reasonable inference or anything more than a guess, really, as to whether that cash is criminal proceeds or whether it is, acquired by different means.
The district court, in its order, says, I'm granting the motion to dismiss. That's not really what happened here, though, is it?
I think it was granting a motion to dismiss. Of course, the legal lens is similar on a motion to dismiss and summary judgment. The record is slightly different. There was relatively little added to the record here.
Well, her deposition testimony was added to the record.
That's right. I should say relatively nothing that helps her case. I mean, what her deposition testimony
said. Well, I'm just trying to figure out, should we review this as if it were a summary judgment, right?
I think that's a fair way to review it. Either way, the review is de novo. Reasonable inferences are granted.
Because it seems to me if we were reviewing simply her petition or her, we might say it's not implausible that she bought some of this with her own money beforehand, even though she didn't specify in particular instances.
Yeah. And I would agree that it is even clearer following the admission she made in her deposition and the evidence added to the record of summary judgment that a fact finder could not reasonably infer and find as to any of the particular money that was seized and any of the particular jewelry based on the sort of lack of memory that she has about it, lack of records. And I would note that I think the Zales, the single ring that is the exception here, where there was a Zales receipt, sort of proves this, that there was evidence. And I agree it doesn't need to be a receipt. It doesn't need to maybe identify the specific date. But what the statute says is first at the pleading stage and then later the time and circumstances of the acquisition need to be adequately identified to allow a reasonable inference at the summary judgment stage to allow a reasonable inference that it was acquired by alternative means.
Counsel, help me out with the spreadsheet here because I see here at least a couple and there could be more pieces of jewelry where she identified were gifts given to Michael and then eventually passed on to their son. Why isn't that sufficient to at least create a tribal issue?
The circumstances under which they were given to Michael, I mean, I think presumptively anything that belonged to Michael, he has conceded that these were criminal proceeds. So as to items that came from him, there's, I don't think any fact in this chart as to those items or otherwise gives reason to reasonably infer that it came from something other than criminal proceeds, that there's an alternative explanation for how it was acquired.
It's a he said, she said type of situation, right? So let's say he basically, as part of the plea agreement, said, okay, the jewelry basically were derived from proceeds. Now she's saying, no, as to specific pieces of jewelry, they were not derived from illegal activity. These were private gifts given to him that was then passed on to the son. Why doesn't that create an issue? Explain that to me again.
We're talking about the pieces of jewelry that were given to Mr. Morgan himself, correct?
Right.
That's the nature of your question. So he, nothing about her statement that they were private gifts given to him undermines the notion that they were derived from criminal proceeds, which he has already acknowledged in his plea agreement. If there was evidence to the contrary, I think that she remembered or could put forward, that could create a triable issue. But I think.
So what does she have to say? It was a private gift given to him by his father?
Yeah, or identifying something more about the circumstances than just this. I think, you know, he had dozens of co-conspirators in this conspiracy. I think just knowing or crediting for purposes of summary judgment that it was a gift to him does not reasonably suggest that it wasn't the criminal proceeds that he has already admitted that, or derived from that he's already admitted that it was. So whether that was a gift given as part of a conspiracy or anything like that, I don't think this reasonably suggests or sort of undermines. I think another way to put it is this chart is fully consistent with the admissions in the plea agreement. It can't be reasonably read to undermine any of those things. And she confirmed in her deposition that this is the extent of her recollection about these items. So there would be nothing to be added at an ancillary hearing. Just to conclude about the Zales receipt and the ring that the district court did exclude here, I think that's an important consideration. Again, I don't think the specific details contained in the receipt were necessary, but something that she could say along the lines of the time and circumstances of when it were acquired that would allow for the reasonable inference that it was innocently acquired or acquired through other means. Unless there are further questions about the 853 question, I might just make a point or two about Rule 41G. To be clear here, the burden given the ongoing investigation to show that return was proper was on Ms. Guadalupe, and she failed that burden. The finding that the investigation was ongoing is reviewed for clear error, and it was clearly supported here based on, again, the facts as they sat at that time.
Government have any plans to try to forfeit these items?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I think that ship has sailed timing-wise. And again, you know, we would be open, you know, we would listen to overtures to return the property, and also, you know, if it came to that, a subsequent Rule 41 motion would be reviewed on the record as it stands now, and that's a very different circumstance. I would note, you know, sentencing remains pending. There's potential, you know, for appeal in 2255 in Mr. Myers' case, but, you know, that the circumstances are certainly different and could be met differently both by the government and or the court if a subsequent petition was submitted. Unless there are other questions from the court, we would rest on the briefs.
Doesn't appear that we have additional questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. We would ask the court to affirm. Thanks.
Just a few brief rebuttal points, Your Honors. One thing that wasn't really addressed in the government's brief and hasn't come up yet is that there is a shifting burden under Rule 41, which basically states that after all the need for the evidence has evaporated, the burden shifts to the government to show why it is still entitled and has a superior interest in the property to the third party. And so in this case, I would assume be in the same boat that you're placing my client in right now, which is that they have to prove that she doesn't have receipts for all that stuff. I'd also like to make a comment on just the nature of depositions in general. I know Your Honors have probably taken a lot of depositions before, or at least have read enough to know kind of what the nature of a deposition is, and the nature of a deposition in a discovery case like this is not that the deponent comes in with all this evidence to completely and fully state her case or his case like at a trial. Rather, it's the government who's called the deposition. They're going to ask her a bunch of questions. Maybe her attorney would, you know, do some qualifying, sort of redirect at the end. But it's not a full-blown hearing. It's targeted questions by the government. And if they don't ask the right questions, she's not stuck with that. I think that
she could have submitted a declaration or an affidavit in connection with these proceedings. I mean, I agree. She doesn't have to volunteer information in a deposition. But when the judge gets to summary adjudication, if we're treating this as if it were summary judgment, it's sort of put up or shut up time. You got to come up with something that creates an issue of fact, right?
Well, true. And I think that her declarations that were sworn, the deposition testimony that was sworn, all the evidence that was seized that effectively she produced. I mean, she was, I think, standing in the shoes of the producing deponent or the producing party. All of that did create a fact question, but the trial court basically shifted the burden to her to prove that all of these items were hers, and I think that the presumption was, and I wasn't there, I'm the appellate counsel, I wasn't at the deposition, I wasn't at the hearing, but I think the assumption was that there was going to be an ancillary hearing, that this thing was not going to get kicked because there was a ton of evidence in front of this judge to create a fact question. And I absolutely think that a trier of fact could look at the even, you know, the Zales receipts and the appraisals and the other documents and say, yeah, she owned at least some of this stuff, maybe not all of it, but you know, that's the purpose of a fact finder. They decide what is owned and what isn't owned. And I think the judge in the trial court simply just jumped the gun and shifted the burden and said, well, I'm going to ignore all this stuff, I don't believe anything she's saying, which was uncontradicted, I should add. I mean, there was nothing from the government other than saying that the cash was mixed or that some of the jewelry and the other things might have been gifts from Morgan. Other than that, without any evidence, there was no evidence. And Morgan's sworn testimony at his plea bargain isn't worth the paper it's printed on. There's plenty of case law we've cited in the brief to that effect. So I would also add that Mr. Morgan has since passed away. He was afflicted with cancer in prison, was released in prison, and died 2 years ago. And now my client is trying to raise her young son on her own, and you know, is facing this battle for this cash that she pulled out of her businesses and the jewelry that she certainly I'm sure could use in this economic environment to help raise her son. So I'd like to pull at the court's heartstrings a bit and just, you know, these are real people, and you know, this is important to her. So, but I thank you for your time, and we would just ask for a remand or such other relief to at least get the ancillary hearing so that all the evidence can come out. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your arguments. The matter is submitted.